I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Out of Spec podcast. I'm your host, Jordan, joined by Ryan Cook, who is a chief technical officer and co-founder of ARC, which is an electric boating company. And I think that's absolutely fascinating. Once I discovered they existed, I kind of wanted to learn everything possible. Ryan has a background with SpaceX, I believe. He's an engineer and an enthusiast at heart, even loves Legos. That's a huge green flag, in my opinion. And just wanted to talk to you, pick your brain about electric boating, some of the challenges, some of the frustrations, but also some of the crazy victories that you've seen along the way.
This episode is made possible by the support we get from Fort Collins Kia. If you are in the market for any electric Kia, not only do they never add market adjustments, they will deliver your car to you anywhere in the 48 contiguous states for out-of-spec viewers. More information in the link in the show notes.
So, Ryan, welcome to the show. Appreciate you being on. And I guess you and Mitch co-founded this company. And how long ago was that?
Yeah, I mean, first, thanks for having me, Jordan. Excited to chat about boating with you today. Mitch and I co-founded the company back in early 2021. It was just the two of us, and we had the idea to try and electrify as much as we can on the water today, and then
very nice
started trying to get after it.
Yeah, and you started with the ARC 1, which I believe is, there's kind of a parallel with, you know, how Tesla started with the Roadster, just like, okay, will this work? And kind of a proof of concept, an initial run. And the ARC 1 is, yeah, kind of like a first run boat that I guess you sold every unit you made, sold out, and now you're working on the next iteration, which is the ARC Sport. Hoping to have a lot of content on that coming up soon on our other channels as well. I wanted to, I guess, find out, as far as the technology is done, how is it sourced? How much is done in-house versus is there shared technology with the automotive space? Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, happy to. Good question. And yeah, it's a good analogy that the ARC 1 is kind of like our equivalent of that early Tesla Roadster. Especially as you talk about how much we do in-house. We did a little bit less in-house for the ARC 1. We do a little bit more in-house now for the ARC Sport. As we go along, you know, that just helps give a better customer experience, helps with our costs that we can pass on to customers as well. In terms of what we do in-house, we obviously do all of the engineering, but on the build side, we build all the hulls and decks, so all the large structures for the ARC 1 that was primarily made out of aluminum. For the ARC Sport, it's all made out of fiberglass. We also do our own battery pack. This lets us create a very large battery pack that's well integrated into the vehicle. That helps us improve range and just overall performance of the vehicle. We can put it exactly where we want it. We can make it as large as we want, which is important for giving users all day range. And then all of the electrical system, and probably most importantly, all of the software is in-house. Every single component on the vehicle is connected to our software system. This not only lets us deliver features right out of the gate that users are not used to in boating, but as what pretty much every consumer has started to get used to in automotive now, we can update it over time. And it's not that we can just update what does the touchscreen look like. We can give you brand new features that did not exist, like cruise control or more driver assist features, like easier, better handling, driver profiles, lots of different like performant features we could flash over the air.
Yeah, so you've touched on some of the benefits. You know, a lot of times people are wondering, okay, if you're electrifying something that is typically considered, you know, combustion engine, watercraft in this case, there's sometimes maybe challenges, but also like unforeseen benefits. Obviously with the automotive space, it was like, oh, instant torque. That's like the party trick of all EVs. It's like, oh, straight line speed. That's crazy. And then, oh, also less maintenance. And like what are some of these benefits that maybe either you didn't foresee or you're starting to realize people are like dumbfounded by because they just didn't put that together?
Yeah. I mean, you've touched on some of the obvious ones from automotive. One is the torque. You've never experienced acceleration like this in a boat before. And I hear you're planning a trip out here too, so that'll be exciting. The other is maintenance. You're absolutely correct there. One thing that, and it's not just maintenance as you think of it in the automotive space, you know, electric, there's fewer moving parts, all of, you know, those reasons. In the marine space, which people who own boats are intimately familiar with, those who are not might not be aware of, but there's usually a long period of time when you're not using your boat, and gas engines do not like to go for a very long period of time without being used. A lot of people in colder climates are familiar with this if they don't own a boat, with like their lawnmowers. In the winter, you usually need to drain all of the fluids. And then in the spring, you're basically guaranteed to have to take that lawnmower or your gas boat to someone to tune it up, basically get it working again after 4 months of just not operational. Or you're like, cross my fingers, hopefully it just starts up, you know, in the spring. That happens with gas boats. It's called winterization. It's a huge pain for boat owners. And it's not so much the cost, it's also just the uncertainty of, oh, did my 12-volt die over the winter? Does the engine need to tune up? Those types of things. But electric, that all goes away. Your boat,
yeah.
You just step off it in September, you walk back on in May, and it's going to work.
I spend a terrifying amount of time on Facebook Marketplace, and it is wild to see how many boats that I can tell are, you know, kind of being sold maybe in the late winter or in the spring, and it's people who are like, just don't want to deal with it. And a lot of times that seems to be a hurdle, and the joke, you know, is the best day of your life is when you buy your boat, and the other best day is when you sell your boat, because people just don't want to deal with all the hassle. And that would be a big turnoff for me myself, because I like to just get in a vehicle and drive. Even like, I mostly cover EVs, but I do have a couple of gas vehicles, and it's just like, every time I finally get a time to drive it, it's like, okay, is there any problems creeping up now? Whereas with an EV, just like you said, get in or get on and drive. That's pretty interesting. What do you say to the people who, you know, I mentioned before the show, like when I tell people, oh, I'm looking at these electric boats, if they didn't know they exist, their first reaction is like, okay, that sounds sketchy. Water with electricity. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking? But I mean, that's a bit of a silly reaction, but also it's a very real common reaction. So that actually led me to a question on, how do you go about the, I guess, protection of the components, as far as the batteries. I mean, there's a lot of engineering that goes into it. And like you said, it's a structural pack, which is pretty sweet. A lot of cars sometimes are going this route. And there's a lot of benefits to that. Tesla, especially lately, has been doing some stuff with structural packs. But as far as the safety is concerned, how do you maintain the battery stays, you know, not wet?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, we do get it. There's three main topics I'll dive into. The first is that high voltage electronics have existed on boats for a very long time. Pretty much especially every ocean going, but any boat that has, they're called hoteling loads. If you have a refrigerator on board or stoves, things like that, boats that have more of cabins, they're running off of a 240 volt AC system. This has existed for decades. If you go to any marina that has shore power, it's called shore power, that they have at the slip, they have 240 volt, 30, 40, 50 amp outlets for you to plug your boat into when you're not there to service those hoteling loads. That's the exact size that an electric vehicle needs. That's what people are installing in their house when they're charging their car. So that has existed in the marine space for a long time. There are standards built up around it. The National Marine Manufacturers Association publishes standards. We adhere to all of those and follow those you know, standards that have existed for decades around high voltage electronics on boats. The second is what you're bringing up with EV automotive. We look to automotive for a lot of what we do. It's, you know, billions of dollars of R&D has gone into automotive EV at this point. We want to leverage that. And automotive, what most people don't realize is a design case is that you're driving through standing water, you're going through car washes, you're getting rained on. So we look at a lot of those standards, and we could get into more details there, but there's IP ratings. This is like water ingress ratings. Your iPhone, for example, is IP67 rated. That means is it can withstand a meter of submersion for up to 30 minutes. That's a pretty standard rating for like waterproof IP67. That's what pretty much all automotive like harness connectors and things are rated to. We hold that minimum standard with everything on our vehicle. For anything that's high voltage on our vehicle, we increase that standard. We go to what's called IP69, which can withstand a high pressure water jet directly at the electrical connection. We use that for our large high current, high voltage connectors. And then probably the last piece here is just internal to ARC. What are we doing? So I touched on what marine does, what automotive does, then internal to ARC. We do a lot of rigorous qualification testing. We take the boats out, we hose them down with water, we fill the bilges with water, we drive them around, we take full battery packs, submerge them in water. We even take the components inside the battery pack and submerge them in water, the modules and the cells themselves, just to see what will happen. And then also see like what does the data look like when you do that. We have a very, I touched on software, advanced telemetry and software system. It's streaming somewhere on the order of 40,000 data points a second off of every single vehicle. And then also looking at data points on the vehicle to make any decisions it needs to about safety. We can feed all this data we've collected from submerging things in water, purposely shorting things. And we know what that looks like. We also know what that looks like before it's an issue. So again, not to get too in the weeds, feel free to stop me, but when you have a positive and negative terminal and you submerge them in water, your resistance is obviously dropping to zero. They are now connected. If they're not fully submerged in water, let's say they're just in a very humid environment or there's a stream of water that's connecting this one, that's slowly inching over to the other one, that resistance is dropping. So it's going to start at some giga ohms of resistance. It will slowly start going down mega ohms, kilo ohms, and then it'll get to zero when you finally make contact. We monitor that. You know, is that resistance dropping over time? And then at a certain threshold that is well above where it would be unsafe, we said, there's an issue. We need to shut off your boat. We need to talk to you, and also try to take measures, you know, even before you get to that point. So the gist is we do a lot internal with physical testing and then safety and monitoring systems.
Yeah, and I guess on the battery pack note, the ARC 1 had something like 200 kilowatt hours, and mm-hmm. the ARC Sport is a bit bigger, like 220 something. Is that like a gross or usable component? I mean, how much of a buffer do you usually work with on the battery pack?
Yeah, it's a good question. The actual usable will probably be a little bit less than that 225 number for a couple reasons. One is we want to add a little bit of buffer on the high and low for longevity. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to the absolute 100%, absolute 0%, your battery will degrade faster over time. We also add a little bit of buffer on the bottom end for if someone is really running their boat down to 0%. We have a little bit of pocket margin there for you, so you can still get back to your dock. And then the last piece is, as you get to really low states of charge, it's harder to draw like a lot of power out of your battery. And so also because you're getting to low states of charge, you'll start to be limited in terms of the speed that you can go. But I wouldn't focus too much on that kilowatt hour number for boating. It's difficult to communicate range with boats. In automotive, it's maybe a little bit more cut and dry. It's basically how many miles can you go? Yeah. Obviously, there's variability, whether there's an incline, how windy it is, those types of things. In boats, there's substantially more variability with how fast you are going. On one of our vehicles, if you were only going 5 miles an hour, you could probably drive the boat for 30 hours straight. If you're going 30 miles an hour, it might be 2 hours straight.
Yep.
So it is a huge variable depending on how fast you're going. We've done a lot of testing, market research, typical usages out on the water. If you're doing a bunch of surf sets, this boat is a wake sport boat. It's one of the big design cases is for surfing. That consumes a lot of power. You throw a really big wave. And we feel pretty confident in the, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours of range guaranteed when you're going out, no matter how you want to use it. And so that's what we quote in terms of range.
So obviously air is so much less dense than water. And so that's why, yeah, people don't even think about the air density. It's just miles. But with cars, you are getting typically much more efficiency at 5 miles an hour than higher speeds. But right. Some cars have like a different threshold of like, oh, like highway sometimes is just as efficient as a bunch of stop and go in a city. With the boats on the design case, is there much of a strategy in designing it differently as far as like the hull shape and stuff than you would a combustion boat? Or are those already so optimized for trying to be efficient, because obviously it sips in those cases a lot of fuel, a lot of gas. Whereas with the EV, you know, I wanted to ask if there's a case for a different design and also towing like a wakeboard or something. Is that a noticeable hit on range like you would see with towing any sort of load with an EV?
Yeah, these are great questions. Let's just talk about hull design first. There's not a ton you can do. You're trading in terms of efficiency because you're trading competing factors when you design a boat hull. You can either try to make it as efficient as possible. To do that, you'd probably have like a flat bottom hull. Think of like, I don't know, a really small like bass fishing boat. A flat bottom hull is great. It's very efficient. It planes very quickly. It operates like an airplane wing. It gets up on top of the water very quickly. That is a more efficient way to drive your boat. That's incredibly uncomfortable when you're going over large waves. It's like a flat bottom. You're just like slamming down. If you want a really smooth ride, you go the opposite. It's very deep V. A lot of ocean going vessels have an incredibly deep V to pierce through the waves, give you a smoother ride as you're going over larger waves. Those are at opposites of each other. So what you're doing a lot of times with hull design is balancing how comfortable is the ride versus how much efficiency you're getting. And then as you look at wake sports, again, I'll reference surfing a lot because it is the design case. It's very power intensive. You're throwing a massive wave. The like third point of this triangle for hull design is like, how efficient is it to throw a very large wave? Well, in general, it's not efficient to throw a really large wave. So you're trading these things as you do a hull design. What I'd say is in general, we've leaned a little bit more towards the efficiency. But because of the weight of our boat, you still have a very smooth, comfortable ride. Now, as to your other question where you're talking about things you do for towing, is there a drop in range? The short answer is no, because of sort of what I was discussing before. There's sort of two design cases for the vehicle. One is a high speed case. So this is a speed demon. They just want to go 30, 35, 40 miles an hour, as long as they're happy to. That consumes a lot of power to maintain those speeds. But it consumes almost as much power to go 10 miles an hour, fully load the boat up with ballast, make it super heavy, and throw a huge wave. So we design around those two cases. The range that we quote is for you doing either or some combination in between. A lot of what our engineering team is focused on is that surf wave, where gas boats don't really need to care too much about the efficiency of throwing a big wave. We care because we're an electric vehicle. So we've done a lot of testing around deployment of surf actuators in the back of the boat, where the ballast physically is positioned, speeds the boat is going, trim angles, roll angles, in order to get a wave that is long, large, lots of push. We could get into all the technical jargon of surf waves, has a very forgivable pocket. We've done a lot of engineering there in order to get you a surf wave that a beginner can surf. They can drop the rope for under 100 kilowatt hours. That was our design case, and that's what we've been able to achieve. For under 100 kilowatts, not kilowatt hours.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to ask, is there a way to measure the efficiency? Like, you know, in the automotive space, in the car space, there's kind of two metrics people use, MPGe, like the equivalent miles per gallon, which frustrates a lot of us because that feels kind of vague. And then there's the miles per kilowatt hour, or, you know, in Tesla's case, watt hours per mile, just depending on how you measure and break that down. Or there's different cases in the European style as well, with kilometers and such. But is there a way that you've used to kind of measure how efficient your boat is compared to gas boats? Is there any really decipherable way to do that? Or is it really vague with, you know, speed is such a dramatic difference on how efficient you're getting?
Yeah, it's tough because speed is such a large variable. Obviously we're benchmarking ourselves against gas boats. How we've done that benchmarking is we've looked at gallons per hour of gas boats. So how many gallons per hour are they burning? And that, again, is just capturing like a typical usage, some amount of time at 10 miles an hour doing surfing, fully loaded, some amount of time at 35 miles an hour, things like that. So we use that for a benchmarking metric. What we do internally is we set targets for ourselves for specific cases. So we want to be under a certain kilowatts for surfing of a wave of these parameters. We want to be around a certain kilowatt target for hitting 35 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour. And that's what we guide the design to. And we derive those kilowatt targets based off of looking at gas boats, but also just the range we want to offer our customers.
Yeah. And I guess as far as power figures, it's around 500 horsepower, or what is that? Maybe high 300s
kilowatt. Yeah, like 370 kilowatt.
Okay. And then as with the charging strategy, that's another question a lot of people have asked me. I just fielded questions when I told people I was going to be talking with you guys. And yeah. a lot of maybe non-marine people are wondering just how in the world you charge these things. As you mentioned, there's actually a fantastic, relatively existing infrastructure with 240 volt capable connections at docking. So I wanted to ask a little bit about that. Like, is that just plug and play, or is there some adaptation that could be needed or wished upon to improve the infrastructure with docks? But then also, what would be like a DC fast charging strategy? Because obviously, a quote unquote level two charger with a 240 volt with a battery pack of this size, you're looking at a decent amount of time to recharge the thing. Now, not everyone's taking their boat out every single day like they would a commute to work on the highway. But if you are looking at a day of like, you know what, we're going to have some speed, which means less time actually out on the water, and then, oh, we need to figure out a DC fast charging stop. How does that infrastructure currently look versus how would you like it to look?
Yeah, all good questions. I'll first state that the entire reason our battery pack is the size that it is because we first said we don't want you to worry about it. So we want it to be the iPhone problem where your boat's going to last you all day. You can charge it at night. Don't want you to worry about it. That's how we arrive at the size of the pack. It's not like the other way around. But then, yeah, as you get into charging, we were talking a little bit before the show why electric boating sometimes makes even more sense than electric cars. Candidly, people don't use their boats that much, and you get a lot of opportunity to charge it. We use our boats a lot, and we use level two charging for everything, and it's sufficient. You know, it's pretty rare to, and takes a very long time to drain from 100% to 0% on one of these boats. So oftentimes you're finishing a day 50%, 60%, sometimes down at 40% charge remaining. That's when you finish your day. You do a whole day of surf development, you know, we'll end the day at 45 or 50% charge remaining. You then end your home by 2 p.m. in the afternoon. You plug it in. By the time you're hitting the water in the morning, 6 or 7 in the morning, your boat's fully charged. So level two charging is sufficient for most people in pretty much most cases. Where it might not be sufficient, maybe you don't have access to it. You have to keep your boat at a mooring ball or something out in the middle of the water. DC fast charging stations are going to be needed. They're starting to pop up on lakes now. I think a lot of people don't realize that. Lake Tahoe already has multiple of them. There are several DC fast chargers going in basically all around the country. So over time, that will continue to pop up and be a like supplemental way that you can charge your vehicle.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have you seen much of a interest in, you know, like for example, other power sports companies, so to speak, like Zero Motorcycles, definitely popular as a kind of a toy, but then also some agencies such as law enforcement has been like, you know what, these would be fantastic for our fleets because a lot of times we're just kind of tootling around, not really going fast. It's something that can last kind of all day, especially at low speeds. Do you see that as a potential in the future with, you know, working with, I don't know what kind of Coast Guard situations exist for like lakes, or does this make sense for that use case? We see the same thing with work trucks, like the work spec F-150 Lightning, amazing for all these city trucks that just sit around and sometimes do short commutes instead of having a truck, you know, idling all day.
Yeah, it definitely makes a lot of sense. That's our perspective. I think that's something that we will get into at some point. It's just not where we're focusing right now. You know, the ARC Sport is the focus for right now. But yes, it definitely makes a lot of sense and is something we're considering.
I guess maybe wrapping up with what do you see as like the upcoming challenges or hurdles, whether it is charging, although it seems like that's actually pretty fantastic right now, but it can always improve even in the EV space. I think it's mostly fine for everyone. If they just bought an EV right now, they could get around the country pretty much relatively effortlessly, but we can always see improvements with that. But I'm wondering, you know, in the EV space, we also see public knowledge as a challenge. You know, someone may roll up with their Bolt and try to plug into the only 350 kilowatt charger, and it's like, your car can't use a fifth of that. Maybe you should leave that for another higher power car. But just like the lack of wherewithal and knowledge, which is honestly, I don't necessarily fault them because they just weren't told sometimes. What do you see as the hurdles in your industry?
Yeah, I mean, public knowledge is always, I mean, it exists in automotive, a lot around charging. I mean, we do get a lot of, you're right, we get a lot of questions, like how fast does a boat charge? The answer is more, it charges like fast enough for how you're actually going to use it. it's usually the answer, which a lot of people aren't most thrilled with, which is why I think DC fast charging is important. It's an area we're interested in leaning into, mostly so we can answer those questions. But I think what a lot of, this is true in electric vehicles too, I think what a lot of people don't fully realize until you own one is that going to the gas station is a huge inconvenience. And like I own an electric car, I also own a gas car. The gas car is way more annoying now because I wake up in the morning and I go to work in the electric car. I never think about refueling it or anything. I'm always late. I'm always busy. I want to go straight from home to work or straight from work to home or some other function. When I have the gas car and it's starting to get to E, I got to go find a gas station. This is like out of my way. This is annoying. I think a lot of people don't realize that when you switch to electric, it's slightly different way, but your lifestyle just is better. It's the same with boating. And I think even in a more extreme way in boating, a lot of people right now have to carry like giant tanks of gas down to their dock in order to fill up their boat. Or they're waiting in long lines. Gas on lakes is incredibly expensive. They know that they have a monopoly and they really upcharge for the gas. So electric is just, again, a much better experience once you understand how the charging works, that you just plug it in and it's ready to go the next morning. You don't have to worry about it. It is more of, you don't have to worry about it. And I think a lot of people until they get there think, oh, it's something I'm going to have to worry about. So that's definitely one. You're right there. I wouldn't say this is a big issue, but it is a call out that boats require a lot of power, way more power than cars. I mean, it's evident in our battery pack size. 226 kilowatt hours is a massive, massive battery pack. And we, you know, we would love to even offer a larger battery pack in the future, I'm sure. That's just, it's very expensive right now. But, you know, we've done a lot of things to bring costs down. We've structurally integrated it. We've turned it into a lot of the performance of the vehicle and the best that we can. So we try to give you great performance and range for, you know, no sacrifice on anything else.
Yeah. With cars, we're seeing a lot of how can we optimize the weight, the power to weight ratio roughly, especially with the battery pack. If you have a car with a bigger battery pack, it's like, okay, that's dramatically affecting the range or even maybe charging or towing performance in a truck and such. Mm-hmm. Is the weight really as huge of an issue with the boats, or, you know, like, are you eyeing maybe semi-solid state in the future because that would help with bringing down the weight, which allows you to fit in more kilowatt hours, or is that just not really as much of a concern?
It's not as much of a concern in boating. We're very much not weight limited. The reason we are weight limited right now is for towing. A lot of people tow their boats, their sport boats like this. They'll keep it at their house, which again is a really easy place for you to charge if you're not using it. And then they'll tow it to the lake, or they'll want to go, you know, lake to lake. Even if they live on one lake, they might want to go to another one. If the boat gets prohibitively heavy, you put yourself into a class of pickup truck that, you know, you don't have access to, or you're going to have to get like that F-350 in order to move your boat around. We don't want to do that. So that's actually where a lot of the weight comes in, right now. But other than that, it's, you know, we're not as weight constrained.
Yep. And sorry, I have so many questions, but I think we'll end it here pretty soon. And we can always, there's a lot more I can get into with ARC, and I'm looking forward to more shows and especially videos in the future and, you know, seeing this thing in person. I guess the last thing I want to ask about is, like, what is, like, you know, like you said, winterization with gas boats, big hurdle and annoyance for a lot of people. With the electric boats, do you have, like, a recommended, like, oh, you're going to put this away for the season? Here's what state of charge to leave the battery. Is there any sort of phantom drain that they might have to worry about? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually where a lot of our engineering effort goes into is these ultra long, ultra low power draw sleep states, because boats do go such a long time. My recommendation is leave it plugged in somewhere, even if it's in just a regular 110 outlet. That really helps. We've got, you know, some patented tech on board that really helps with long-term storage states if you're just plugged into something over the winter. If you can't be plugged into something, that's also okay. We ask that you just get it to as full a charge as you can before you put it into storage. As I mentioned, we have deep sleep states where it will last, you know, months not plugged in. And if you do get to the point that you're fully dead, the vehicle will save itself and shut off. And so when you come back in the spring, all you have to do is just plug it in, let it charge up, and then you'll be in a good spot.
Yeah. So are you not too worried about people leaving it at, like, you know, 100% state of charge, which I know there's a buffer beyond 100, but are you worried about the longevity of the battery with that either super high or super low? Like, is there a best case scenario of what they leave it at, or is it engineered to, like, handle pretty much anything?
It's engineered to handle pretty much anything. We do a lot of our own internal cycling of the battery and have our code all based around that testing. One just note is, as I mentioned, people don't use their boats nearly as much as they use their cars. So the number of cycles people are putting on their boats is very, very low. And so in general, it's not really a concern to always go up to 100% every single time you charge it. You're not going to come anywhere close to the cycle counts that these battery cells are honestly designed for, which is on the automotive side.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time, Ryan, and looking forward to sharing the ARC Sport and maybe even look at the ARC 1. You know, even though it's sold out, I still see it as a cool, you know, initial showcase of what your technology is about. And I think our audience is very fascinated, whether they are in boating and they're fascinated for their own personal selfish, like, give me a boat, or they're fascinated because they have an EV and they're wondering what else is happening in the industry that's going to be electrified. So looking forward to some videos over on Out of Spec Reviews and other channels. And in the meantime, happy to podcast with you, and I'm looking forward to another show.
Yeah, no, same here. It's been a pleasure chatting, and thanks for having me on.